From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, why all of Texas needs to be praying to keep hurricanes away from the state, why some bills in Austin became law and others didn't, follow the money, and the hot summer is coming, and will the state's power grid be up to the task? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Time is running out for the Texas legislature. Monday is the close of the session, and even though you never know what's done until that last pounding of the gavel, this legislature might be known more for what didn't get passed. There's almost a certainty there will be a special session this summer, and the lawmakers will be called back to Austin to get her done one way or another. So far, it looks like Democrats, the minority party, were successful in blocking Governor Perry's priority issues like drug testing for public assistance, new restrictions on abortion, campus carry for guns, tax breaks for businesses, and one issue that Perry opposed that didn't get passed, Medicaid expansion. And here's one more thing that didn't get done, fixing the Texas Windstorm Insurance Program. University of Houston law professor Seth Chandler has been tracking the issue with his blog, Texas Windstorm, and says this is a problem that could cost the state and taxpayers billions of dollars.
The catastrophic insurer that it's created, the Texas Windstorm Insurance Association, will not have enough funds to pay claims fully in the event of a significant storm.
So the Texas Windstorm, this is a state agency?
Technically, it's not an agency. It's a state-created corporation that covers about 62% of the property owned on the Texas coast.
So that's about 275,000 property owners on the Texas coast.
That's correct. 275,000 policies are currently issued by TWIA.
Why does the state of Texas need to provide a last resort insurer for these folks? Why can't they just get one of these commercial insurers?
That's a very good question. The original theory was that insurers would not write on the coast because the risk was too high. And as a result, in the 1970s, Texas established this then small windstorm insurer to help people out. But as it's turned out, in part because the Windstorm Association is charging premiums that are far lower than what the market would charge, insurers are generally unwilling to come in. And as a result, the Windstorm Association has now grown until it's no longer the insurer of last resort for most people. It's basically the insurer of first resort for many people on the coast.
So they are providing insurance at a cut rate that so commercial insurers, which would be more competitive, they can't compete.
That's correct. And the issue is just how much higher would the premiums be for commercial insurers, and estimates there range anywhere between 5% higher on some parts of the Texas coast, but up to possibly 100% higher if you're right on the beach and bearing the brunt of the strongest winds.
So if you're in Galveston, you would see a double in your insurance rates for your property, which that would be a lot of money.
Parts of Galveston might see very substantial increases in their rates were the state pool to disappear.
Okay, so here we have we had a hurricane 5 years ago.
Yes, we did, Hurricane Ike, and Ike is the cause of many of the problems. The lawsuits and claims arising out of Hurricane Ike have basically rendered the Windstorm Association insolvent. It has some cash lying around, but not enough to pay claims in the event of an Ike-sized hurricane this summer or next.
So we get another Hurricane Ike hitting the Texas coast. All these folks have this Texas Windstorm insurance policy, and the state of Texas, is it obligated to make these people whole?
The state of Texas is under no legal obligation to make these people whole. Moreover, There's a guarantee fund which is available to policyholders of private insurers that is not available to these TWIA policyholders. So the question is, everyone agrees that TWIA does not have enough money. The only real issue is how bad would it have to be before TWIA really ran out of money? And estimates there range anywhere from, at the low end, maybe a $500 million storm. That is about a fifth or a sixth of Ike, up to about a $3 billion storm, which is about the size of Ike. My own view is it's probably around $1 billion, which is about a third of an Ike storm, would bankrupt TWIA.
So by bankrupting TWIA, the Texas Windstorm Insurance Group, then these people have policies, but they're not going to be made good, so they're not going to get the benefit of having these policies. Do they just assume that the state of Texas will pick up the tab, will bail them out?
I don't know what people are assuming. They're not being warned by TWIA about the risks of insolvency. But I can tell you there is no legal obligation on the part of Texas to do so. And I don't know whether there would be political will to tap into the rainy day fund or some other source of money and pay a couple of billion dollars for people who are receiving subsidized insurance already.
So the issue for folks who do not live on the Texas coast is, am I going to end up paying for people's vacation homes that got destroyed by a hurricane?
Right. Well, that's one way of looking at it. You're definitely going to pay, because already these bonds that would be issued to finance TWIA after a hurricane, those will be paid for in part by people inland and by coastal property owners who have managed to secure private insurance. They're going to be hit up too, and people will be hit on their auto policies, their homeowner policies, all sorts of policies to pay for these claims. The worst question is, what happens when even that money, the money they raise from bonds, isn't enough to pay off these windstorm policy holders? Are those people just going to live with blue roofs over their lives, over their houses for
years?
Blue tarps over their houses for years, or somehow money going to magically appear to help people out?
You know, that's not unusual to see blue tarps on people's houses even now. That they never actually got around to fixing their homes for whatever reason out there.
Right, but imagine what happens if you're only being paid, say, 50 cents on every legitimate dollar of claim that you have. That is, the insurance company says, yeah, we agree we owe you $20,000, but because we don't have enough money, we're only paying 50 cents on the dollar. And so that means that the homeowner or the business is either going to have to come up with that extra $10,000, or they're just going to have to live with a structure that doesn't function the way they wanted.
So are we just living in this state of denial or wishful thinking right now and praying that Texas will be safe from a major hurricane? And are we working on a solution? What's going on?
We are currently engaged in prayer-based insurance schemes. And my own view is that God helps those who help themselves, and that we are therefore in a serious situation. The legislature has been wrangling about how to fix this over the past 6 months, and as the session winds down, they basically have not been able to agree on a solution. There's some thought the governor might call the legislature into special session and add windstorm insurance to the agenda, but no one knows yet if that's in fact going to happen.
Why not just have Texas get out of the windstorm insurance business altogether and let the commercial industry figure it out? You know, let the free market get involved.
Right. So that's one of the things that has been proposed. And in fact, there was a bill in the Senate this year that would have transitioned over a 5 to 10 year period into a system that was much more free market oriented and that got insurers involved. However, because of the way it was done, coastal insureds didn't like it because it would mean the end of their subsidies. Insurers, some of them, didn't like it because they thought the political process would actually set the rates too low and they'd still lose money. And that bill basically never escaped committee. So there have been proposals to go back to a free market on the Texas coast. But at the moment, those do not have enough political support to win.
Are people concerned about You know, we're not talking about little tiny hurricanes anymore. The hurricanes that pop up, when they do pop up, are pretty severe. We're not, the 1950s style hurricanes are a thing of the past.
Well, this is the problem, that we have not only possibly stronger hurricanes, but we also, and this is the more important point, have much more development on the coast, in part because of the subsidized insurance that's occurred. So a storm that 20, 30 years ago might have caused $100, $200 million worth of damage is now a $500 to $1 billion storm because there has been significantly more development on the coast. The problem is that our insurance system has not kept pace with the growing risk.
If we were to set the insurance rate at the appropriate level that the market could withstand, would that cripple the economy of the coast?
It would definitely hurt the coastal economy in the short run. There's no question that many people would pay more in premiums. The benefits, though, would be that you would have a sustainable insurance system that would actually work in the event of a significant hurricane. The problem we have now is we're being rather short-sighted. We are subsidizing development by having rates that are not commensurate with the risk. And then when a storm actually comes, we don't seem to have the political will to fund this insurance adequately so that policyholders will be paid.
Now, I can't help but have this conversation and think, what if we exchange the word, you know, windstorm for Obamacare? You know, we hear Obamacare is socialism. It's a national, it's a healthcare system, an insurance system. Why is?
Yeah, well, it's amazing to me that of the risks that we're going to socialize in Texas, one of our first stops is property insurance, often for wealthy people. These are million-dollar homes that are gaining the benefit of these subsidies. And if I were going to choose to subsidize some form of insurance, I would not start with property insurance for wealthy people with second homes on the beach.
Seth Chandler is a professor of law at the University of Houston. He also writes the blog Texas Windstorm. He says the Texas Windstorm Insurance Program is broke, and without a costly legislative fix, the state is vulnerable to billions of dollars in losses if a major hurricane hits the state. As the Texas legislature works its way through the last hours of the session to the close on May 27th, it's a wonder why some bills make it through the cumbersome process to become law and others fall to the wayside. It's a wonder until you look at the flow of the money and the march of the lobbyist. Denise Roth Barber is with the National Institute for Money in State Politics. She says citizens need to follow the money.
Well, the Texans for Lawsuit Reform was the largest donor to the current Texas legislators at nearly $3.3 million, followed by Bob Perry, who recently passed away, and he gave lawmakers a little over $2 million during the 2012 elections. Texas Association of Realtors, $1.1 million. Border Health, $982,000, and a law firm by the name of Mostyn. I may have pronounced that wrong, but it gave just under $800,000.
That's a wide range. The top one giving over $3 million. Number five coming in just under $800,000.
Right.
So Texans for Lawsuit Reform, they must really love the legislative process.
Right. And, you know, they have a pretty specific agenda, if you will, a fairly broad base of supporters, so they are an active player at the Texas legislature, obviously.
Now, you also found some other interesting items. What else?
Well, when we put all of the donors, and the data that we have is what was reported by the people who ran for state-level office in Texas during 2012. And by state-level office, I mean people who ran for the legislature and any of the statewide offices that were up for election in the high courts in 2012. Most of the money raised was raised by the people who were running for the state house, in which every seat was up, as well as the state senate, in which half of the seats were up. And Texas is one of 12 states that do not limit the amount of money that individuals and PACs, political action committees, can give to candidates. So that's largely why we're seeing very large donations they're allowed to give. Most states, you know, restrict the giving in some way. And so what we do is we take all those contribution reports and we enter them into a database and we assign economic codes to the donors. And what we found is in Texas, the donors that were related to the finance, insurance, and real estate economic sector, when you put them all together, they were the largest set of donors with $9.5 million to the legislators. Now, they gave more to other committees, people who lost, political party committees, et cetera, but we took a look at, of those who ran in 2012, how much did they get? How much was raised by those who won and are currently in office? Second was the lawyers and lobbyists, which includes law firms, and they gave $7.8 million. General business, which is a really broad business category, at $7 million. Energy and natural resource donors, $5.8 million, followed by donors affiliated with the health sector at $5.7 million.
And so we can come up with this raw data, how much money is being given from these sectors, but we really don't know much more than that unless you start digging in deeper. Like when you say Texans for lawsuit reform gave $3.3 million, you know, but what do you make of that? You know, what do we know about Texans for lawsuit reform? We know they want tort reform. They want to restrict, make it harder for people to sue and things like that. Mm-hmm. But that's it.
Right. Right, that's true. So what does that mean? And, you know, it's up to individuals to, if they're interested, to find out a little bit more, like who do they give to, what positions of power are these legislators in, what committees do they sit on. And at followthemoney.org, we have a interesting tool called the LCAT, Legislative Committee Tool. And if you're following a particular bill, and you know the committees that the bill is going through, you can look at, and on our website, using our LCAT tool, you can look at where the money came from to the members who sit on the various committees.
And so this is something that anyone can do. Just go to your website and sort of start clicking around.
Right, followthemoney.org. And it's all public record. These are contributions as reported by the people who received them. So, for example, Larry Taylor, current senator, state Texas senator, he received the most. He received 18 contributions from the Texans for lawsuit reform, totaling $883,000.
Right.
You can see that on our website. And this is what Larry Taylor reported to the state. So, again, I just want to emphasize this is all public record.
Yeah, and because Texas has such lax political contribution laws that, you know, they make this, we're not saying these companies are doing anything illegal or these sectors are doing anything illegal, but voters have a right to know who's paying for what.
That's right. So, you know, there is a decent disclosure system in the state. So that's a good thing to have in a state where there are no limits. It does, at least the public is able to see with clarity who is giving to whom. And they can make their own judgments as to whether or not those donors are getting undue influence over policies.
Denise Roth-Barber is a managing director for the National Institute of Money in State Politics. They run the website followthemoney.org. Memorial Day is considered the official kickoff to the hot summer, and that means get ready for those long, hot days and the roars of the straining air conditioners. And that won't be the only thing that's straining. The state's electric grid will once again be put to the test. ERCOT is the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, and they say they are ready. Kent Sathoff is the executive advisor to ERCOT.
Well, we are forecasting for this summer a load of a little over 68,000 megawatts. And that's almost, but not quite, as much as our peak demand in 2011, which was the really all-time hottest summer recorded.
So what does that mean for, you know, for you guys who manage the, you know, the Texas electric reliability-ness?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do seasonal reliability analysis before each season. And May 1st, we issued our final summer analysis for this summer. And assuming that we have that 68,000 or so megawatts demand, and we have normal generator outages that we historically have experienced, we expect that we'll be all right this summer, although it will be tight during some afternoons where we hit those high peaks. But under those assumptions, we feel like we'll be all right this summer. However, we may issue appeals to the public to conserve during the peak hours of about 3 in the afternoon to 7 in the evening.
Right. So electric use is highest typically between 3 and 7 o'clock on the hottest days of the year. So if we run into the unexpected, and they always say, how do you plan for the unexpected? You can't. With this, some extreme scenarios, what could be the result of that?
Well, we do plan for extreme scenarios. We have what we call our energy emergency alert process that we go through. And when our reserves get below a critical level, we will start and enter into that energy emergency alert process. And it entails essentially making sure all available generators are online and generating. And then it progresses to interruptible customers that have agreed through contract or through a market to voluntarily shut down their loads. And then the very last step is rolling outages of firm customers where the utilities will shut down blocks of their load on a rotating basis. And that amount that is subject to the rolling outages will depend on what the conditions are at the time. So we have a process that we go through, and before we even enter that process, we'll do public appeals for conservation if we see that there's a good chance we might get into that process.
But shouldn't people be practicing at least some level of conservation just on a day-to-day basis, particularly during the summertime?
Absolutely. If the public voluntarily, you know, practices conservation, it's certainly good for us, and it's good for them. They'll save some money. You know, particularly residential air conditioning. Residential load during our summer peak period is about 50% of our total. And that's largely air conditioning. So if all residential customers would increase their thermostat setting by 2 degrees, it would make a huge difference for us. You know, it would be equivalent to a large power plant.
So here we are getting ready to go into the hot summertime in Texas. So this is when people at ERCOT say, okay, now it gets real, and all hands on deck, and we're going to make sure that we can do everything we can to make sure that the power is reliable in Texas.
Yes, that we certainly do get prepared for the summer because one thing we know, it's going to be hot, and we're going to have high demands. So the fact that we know that certainly helps us prepare, and we're probably less likely during the summer to experience things we don't expect than we are during some other times of the year.
Kent Sathoff is an executive advisor to ERCOT. He says the Electric Reliability Council of Texas should be able to avoid rolling brownouts this summer, but still he urges consumers to exercise common sense power conservation when they can. In the rural border areas of Texas, 7 so-called informal crossings were shut down following 9/11. These were border villages and rural economies that thrived on their interdependence. The actual border was invisible, but the shutdown destroyed that connection. Recently, 2 border villages were reunited briefly for a one-day celebration. Marfa Public Radio's Lauren Madelon reports from the international boundary at the midpoint of the Rio Grande in rural Texas.
For one glorious moment, real-world politics was forgotten. Paso Lajitas, Mexico, and Lajitas, Texas were again united, not cut off from one another, as they've been in a post-9/11 world.
Something incredible.
With good wishes from law enforcement in both countries and advice that no laws would be broken if people met on and literally in the river, the Rio Grande was crowded after a separation of 11 years.
Yo pienso que no era motivo de que se nos cerrara este cruce.
That's Ramon Garcia, the county chief on the Mexican side. He says the notion that the U.S. is more secure in rural areas because the border is sealed is incorrect.
Estados Unidos, según cerró este cruce, porque tenía temor a que terroristas entraran por esta área.
The U.S. supposedly closed this informal crossing because it feared terrorists would come in through this area, Garcia says. But I don't believe terrorists would come through an area under constant surveillance and where there are so few people. Strangers stand out here, says Garcia.
Good morning, good morning.
The U.S. agrees at least partially. It's just opened a formal border crossing linking the once vibrant pueblo of Boquillas, Mexico with Big Bend National Park in Texas. It's a signal the U.S. no longer believes the threat is worthy of maintaining a sealed border here.
We love playing for our neighbors, let me tell you something.
That's Jeff Hazlip of Terlingua, Texas, right before he serenaded Mexicans looking into the U.S. from feet away. He lobbied politicians and law enforcement in 2 countries to make sure the day did not become an international incident. Steps below where Hazlip spoke, people wandered into the river in jeans and boots. I met Alejandro Lujan from Paso Lajitas. He waded in from Mexico to the midpoint in the river. So geographically, my microphone is in the United States, and Lujan is in Mexico.
We don't want nothing else to happen. We don't want terrorists to pass. We don't, I mean, obviously, you know, the United States is our neighbor country. We don't want nothing to happen, you know, attack us or attack them. You know, we just want to see our family, you know. That's what we need to see. I mean, our number one priority is our family. Always, always.
People here, where voices from one side echo on the other, well, they accept the way the sun set on a different world after September 11th, 2001. But listen to the bilingual narrative of Isabel Rodriguez. She saw her brother and sister, who live legally in Texas, for the first time in a decade.
Están separando familia. I know. Separate the family.
Separating the family.
Uh-huh. And right now it's happy for the see my brother and my sister.
Por la primera vez, for the first time in 10 años, in 10 years.
Uh-huh. Yes. I'm happy, happy. Bien feliz.
Muy feo. Pues estamos solos para acá y no convivimos.
Isabel's sister Rita says the last 10 years have been ugly. The population of Paso Lajitas has dwindled to a handful of people. What unfolded here does not imply an imminent relaxing of border restrictions, but it does signal an awareness that rural Texas is not like San Diego, Tijuana, or El Paso, Juarez, and that for a few hours, in the middle of this part of the river, there's little risk if friends and family get together. I'm Lorne Madelon.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also comment on the show on our website, and you can listen to past Texas Matters programs on our website, tpr.org. And you can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.